You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 9th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. It's been a rather dark start to the new year for press freedom in China, with reports this week of four people from Hong Kong's publishing industry mysteriously missing. What's it like to live and work under the country's watchful eye? And just how effective are China's intense attempts at controlling its media? We'll ask someone who knows all too well today on The Stack. On today's programme, we'll take a closer look at how China's press functions under the often suffocating control and censorship of the state.
And I remember once the then propaganda director of the Communist Party, this is in the late 90s, saying that so long as the Communist Party remained in power, there would be no independent media in China. It wants to keep control of that.
Plus, we'll hear from one of the voices behind Hong Kong Free Press, an organisation that rebels against the very concept of government interference.
Just before we launched, we suffered a cyber attack. And also we're banned in the mainland, it's censored.
So how does censorship affect a media organisation's core values? We'll be exploring that and plenty more besides on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack. We're taking the temperature of press freedom around the world today with a particular focus on Asia. This week saw international news reporting on five people from Hong Kong's publishing industry who've mysteriously vanished. The silence emanating from China prompted the UK to remind the former British colony of its commitment to press freedom. So what's it really like to operate a media organisation under the watchful eye of a paranoid government and the constant threat of censorship or worse? Jonathan Fenby is a former editor of the South China Morning Post and the author of eight books focused on the region, among many other accolades that he's secured. He's currently the managing director of China research at Trusted Sources. Jonathan, welcome to The Stack. Very good to have you.
Glad to be here.
I'd like to start by asking you, I suppose, about we're used to the international media voicing its opinions about press freedom or lack of it in China, whether on the mainland or in other offshoots. But what's the view from within about it? Is it as contentious a subject as we perhaps imagine it to be?
Probably not so, frankly. Although, of course, the growth of social media and the way that if you invest a little in the right kind of connections, if you're within mainland China, you can connect quite easily with Hong Kong and through that to the rest of the world. So the Great Firewall of China is not as efficient, as effective these days as it used to be in the past. That said, in China, all conventional media are owned by a branch of the Communist Party or the government, including the army, including the Youth League of the Communist Party, and so on and so on. And there is a lot of censorship. You get newspapers coming out with identical front pages, the photograph of the leadership, which everybody has to show, and so on. That said, within those pretty strict parameters, some journalists have managed to exercise a good degree of freedom. It's either usually because they are backed by a regional authority, the Communist Party, for instance, in southern China, which would allow relatively more liberal publications to operate, although they've become under a lot of pressure recently, or in the business area, where members of the leadership, the establishment, if you like, who thought that China, for instance, needed a more efficient, less corrupt stock market, would encourage magazines to do investigative reporting into stock market scams. And some of these were absolutely wonderful, including one of a group of insider dealers who used to meet in a steam bath, all completely naked, so that none of them could communicate with their mobile phones outside while they were having their discussions. And quite a lot of that reporting has been very good, but it's interesting, I mean, in the case of one such business publication, when it stepped over the line and started writing about ethnic unrest in the western province of Xinjiang, it promptly got into trouble. So the independent journalists who manage to operate in China do so knowing the parameters within which they're functioning.
Well, talking about those parameters then, let's look back at your own experience at the South China Morning Post, operating obviously out of Hong Kong. What were the, I don't know, the pressures that were exerted either directly or indirectly from state machinery or other sources. Like, what was the actual experience like of operating as a journalist in that environment?
I mean, I was fortunate in a way because I edited the paper for 2.5 years before the handover and 2.5 years after the handover. You know, as you might say, I did half my time under British colonialism and half my time under Chinese colonialism. And there was very little direct pressure from the Chinese authorities, it must be said, right towards the end of my time. I remember once a Chinese ministry in Beijing took us to task for running opinion polls, which showed that C.H. Tung, the chief executive of Hong Kong, was less than very popular. And our political editor was told, why do you run these polls? Of course they're wrong. Everybody knows Mr. Tung is very popular. Get some new polls, as it were, and so on. But I was extremely fortunate because the paper was a very strange animal at that time. It was an English language paper in a colony where very few people understood English well enough actually to read the paper. So you had a very limited readership, about 250,000. But at the same time, those readers were very rich and the advertisers wanted them. And so the advertising was absolutely phenomenal. In some years, it was the most profitable newspaper in the world, 100 million clear profit on a circulation of 120,000. You wouldn't find much like that. I had about 300 journalists and so on. And those people wanted good independent journalism. They didn't want to read a paper which would just say, you know, Beijing is right, Beijing is right, Beijing is right. They were comparing us with the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, which was very flattering for us. And the pressure on me came rather from the owner of the paper, who was a Malaysian Chinese businessman who bought it from Rupert Murdoch some years before I went out there. And on the one hand, he liked the profits very much indeed.
Oh, I'll bet he did.
On the other hand, he was always worried that we were not sufficiently China-friendly and so on. And he would haul me over the coals regularly for various stories we wrote. He didn't like some of the senior staff on the paper. He told me to drop columnists who he thought were anti-China and so on and so on. To which my reply was two replies. Well, if you want to do that, I'm not going to do it. Sack me and you can appoint someone who will do it for you. But if you do that, you're actually going to kill the golden goose, largely. So that was quite all right. On the other hand, you could sense, I think, in Hong Kong, much more in the Chinese language press, as time went on, that there were pressures. But again, they very often came through the owners, who very often would have commercial interests in mainland China. So this is a slightly lopsided view. I mean, we didn't have to show the courage or the cleverness that some mainstream Chinese newspapers and journalists have shown navigating within the rules. And of course, the same was so, let's say, in Eastern Europe, just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, where you could go so far, but you couldn't go any further.
Interesting to pick up that point you said there, describing your relationship with the then owner. It strikes me, obviously, towards the end of last year, we saw Jack Ma take over the South China Morning Post. Now, that's been greeted with, an interesting range of reactions, so we say, from within and without. What was your initial reaction, I wonder, when you learned of that news?
Well, it was not surprising. Well, I mean, I couldn't say I knew it was going to happen. But the owner in my time, Robert Kwok, had wanted to sell for some time. In fact, he thought of selling the paper when I was still there. But basically, he could own, because of the politics, he's a big investor in China, very much involved with Beijing and mainland China. And it became clear that he could only sell it to a mainland Chinese or somebody the Beijing approved of. And of course, Jack Ma fits that bill well. I must say that the initial statement made by Ma's lieutenant about this, which was a fairly familiar theme, which is China gets a bad press, we are going to balance that bad press. I think we know the kind of editorial line which will be taken there. But it may well be that Ma sees this as part of a bigger media operation by him. So in that sense, you know, yes, it's nice to have the SCMP, but it's not as important for him as it might be if you were just looking at it as a newspaper. Mm-hmm. It may be just part of a constellation.
Let's take a sort of a step even further back then and look at how the Chinese state views its internal media and some of these other operators. Do you think that Beijing achieves its aims when it comes to how it manages the media? Is there a coherent agenda that it either succeeds in achieving or otherwise?
Well, the answer is yes and no. Yes, it succeeds in putting, in enforcing its view of what's happening in China and what's happening in the world. I mean, you have some varieties of degrees of expression, let us say. We have the rather stately Communist Party newspaper, People's Daily. You then have a daily tabloid, Global Times, which is really pretty, you know, shouting it from the rooftop. So you may get a difference in tone there. But the leadership, and remember, always remember, China is the last big Leninist state where the Communist Party is more powerful than the government. So we're talking about the Communist Party. The Communist Party has always understood or seen the importance of controlling information as a power tool. And I remember once the then propaganda director of the Communist Party, this is in the late 90s, saying that so long as the Communist Party remained in power, there would be no independent media in China. It wants to keep control of that. Now, in that sense, yes, it succeeds, there's no doubt. And you've got the, however many it is, 30,000 cyber cops who are trawling the internet the whole time to find any mention of the Dalai Lama or anything else. You've got, but on the other hand, you have both, because of technology, it's much easier to get information in China for people who want to get it. And then you have social media, which I think is, if I say a game changer, I'm not sure quite how it's going to change the game in the end. But the fact now that hundreds of millions of people can communicate directly with each other in a society where the political leadership has always controlled communication of itself, I think is a big change.
How long do you think that situation is sustainable for the party to attempt
I think it is sustainable, and it will go on. The growth, you know, it's like with the Chinese diet. You know, people have got used to eating meat more than once a week, let's say. They've got used to eating pizzas. You know, I was brought up believing the Chinese couldn't digest milk or dairy products. Well, they make pizzas. There's even a firm in Shanghai which makes chocolate-flavoured cheese for chocolate-flavoured cheese pizzas, if you can imagine the idea. You can't take that away from people, and I don't think you could take away the versions of social media. Now, of course, most of the conversations on social media aren't political at all. They are, I had a nice bowl of congee this morning, I saw your girlfriend out with another boy last night, have you seen the latest film, whatever it may be. Of course it's that. But it's the act of communication that is important. Now, there is an attempt to control that, quite obviously. And you could say that figures like Jack Ma, I mean, Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, all the other social media and new media platforms there are being controlled in the sense that they know that in the end, the party state could close them down. I mean, it's not they're receiving orders the whole time, you know, check up on Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so because they send a message about Xi Jinping. No, I mean, it's not that. But the space within which Chinese new media operate is set by the regulators, by the police, by the cyber cops, and ultimately by the Politburo of the Communist Party.
The insights of Jonathan Fenby here on The Stack, and we'll be hearing more from Jonathan in a moment or two. For now, though, I want to hand over to Kurt Lin in Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau, who's been chatting to one of the people behind Hong Kong Free Press.
Thanks, Tom. Hong Kong Free Press is a non-profit English-language news source that aims to unite critical voices on local and national affairs. But operating a media outlet in Hong Kong isn't without its challenges. A little earlier, I spoke to the organization's editor-in-chief, Tom Grundy, and started by asking about his view on the recent case of a publisher in Hong Kong who holds a British passport mysteriously disappearing, and suspicions that the Chinese government may be involved.
Well, this news greeted me after a short break I had, and coming back in the new year, you know, it's just that, like, there's no breathing room. It's one thing after the other. It seems like a constant assault on what differentiates Hong Kong from the mainland, and a total affront to the one country, two systems agreement that you know, guarantees Hong Kong's autonomy. The fact that someone can be supposedly plucked from the city and taken to the mainland, it's very much a mystery. I mean, there's a lot of contradictory and new developments coming out every day. We've a reporter out now visiting some of the other banned bookshops, but it's another new and scary precedent, and it often feels that all of these important institutions and civil liberties that are held dear in Hong Kong under attack. If, you know, last year it was academic freedom, the rule of law, and this is, you know, another aside to press freedom in Hong Kong, which is why we exist, of course.
Some say the downgrading freedom is due to the self-censorship, like some publisher would just give out their freedom, or like Page One, the bookstore, they just stopped selling the sensitive book recently after the case. And what do you think about this?
Yeah, unbelievably, just roll over like this, you know, Page One, within moments of this news, you know, and they just fall in line. I can't understand it, it's bizarre, and that of course is self-censorship. But, you know, I think in the wider press freedom issue, it's a mix of challenges. Self-censorship does happen. We are structured in a way so that we don't have that problem. You also have physical attacks on journalists. There have been dozens in the last few years. Commercial boycotts. So the pro-democracy Apple Daily, for instance, is boycotted by HSBC and Standard Chartered because of their interests in the mainland. You have plurality and ownership issues. So there is a very narrow sort of diversity of politics in some of the publications and newspapers here. And many of them are owned by Beijing or by pro-Beijing entities or companies, such as, you know, the Alibaba buyout of the flagship South China Morning Post here in the city. And if you look at any of the international and local sort of watchdogs and indices on press freedom, from Freedom House, Reporters Without Borders, Committed to Protect Journalists, they've charted this rather rapid decline. It was hardly a slow erosion just in the last few years under the leadership of CY Leung. So, you know, I think the wider picture, it doesn't so much feel like Hong Kong's identity, autonomy, and its institutions are being eroded. It's more like it's being integrated into China and the Pearl River Delta region, and there's this wider fear that we will simply become another grey sort of second-tier city, rather irrelevantly absorbed into the Pearl River Delta region. And when 2047 comes and Hong Kong's autonomy expires, we may just become another part of China, and that's what people fear. They look at Taiwan and look at Macau, and it can feel like a lot more one country than two systems sometimes.
Have you personally faced any interference or political pressure?
Not personally, but Hong Kong Free Press has had its challenges. Just before we launched, we suffered a cyber attack. We have a cyber squatter. We have the government hindering us locally, in that because we're online, we can't access government press conferences or government press releases, which is absurd because we're a registered company, we've got an office, professional, qualified staff. So we're fighting them on that. And also we're banned in the mainland. It's censored. After our first few months, we found it's inaccessible over the border. Other than that, in our reporting, we've been okay, but we're structured in a way to protect ourselves.
Monocle's Kurt Lin there in conversation with Tom Grundy from Hong Kong Free Press. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. And the series kicks off with London and with New York City. New York used to be such an easy city to crack for the visitor, but now its focus has fractured and shifted. Why not let Monocle help you to navigate it?
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Monocle has had a bureau in New York since its launch in 2007, and our travel guide is a celebration of all that we know and love about this place. We put together a list of the finest places and experiences the Big Apple has to offer, be it a cozy stay at the Cosby Street Hotel, a late drink in a classic bar like King Cole in Midtown, or a top-notch fuss-free trim at Cheese in Brooklyn. Let us take you beyond the obvious to reveal the hidden spots New York has to offer. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. So pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to New York in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're back with The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me is Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post and author of many books focusing on the region and wider journalistic practice. Jonathan, I wanted to sort of pick your brain as someone who's worked in so many different markets all around the world about some of the, I guess, ideological differences that we see in terms of how different states, regimes, call them what you like, view their media and their role when it comes to regulating it or supervising it, to speak slightly euphemistically. First off, I guess it may seem an obvious question, but why do you think so many states, given the fragmentation of media and the digitalization of it, remain so wedded to this idea of keeping an almost vice-like grip, particularly on the print media? Surely by now the grip should be loosened a little as we become familiar with the new landscape.
Yeah, I mean, I think technology is loosening it, in fact. And if you see the role of social media in, for instance, the Arab Spring or in Ukraine or elsewhere, that's enormous. And indeed in China, because there's been a big explosion, it's probably too strong a word, but of people going for officials in China through social media. There was a famous case where an official in Shaanxi province in the north was photographed at the scene of a terrible bus accident, and he was apparently laughing. And this shot round everybody, the laughing official. He couldn't care about 25 people killed. He was laughing. And then somebody noticed that he was wearing a very expensive Swiss watch. And then other people on the circuit, social media circuit, collected other photographs of him wearing other extremely expensive Swiss watches. And this became a great, enormous joke and so on. And eventually the police raided his apartment and found he had, I think it was 86 Swiss watches there. So you can see the effect of that. And even there was the case after it when there was an earthquake in Sichuan province in southwest China a little while later. And there was a picture there, which became famous, of an official standing. And you could see he was wearing a short-sleeved shirt, and you could see the mark of where his watch had been, but he didn't want to be photographed with this Rolex or whatever it was, and had taken it off. And he was wearing very tight trousers, and you could see it in his pocket. So you can see that there is an effect there. No, I think it's easy for me to say, of course, this, because I've never been a politician, but I think, in a sense, politicians are overrate the immediate effect of the media. I think the media create a climate, a context, but you know, the immediate effect of an article criticizing Barack Obama or David Cameron or Xi Jinping or so on is really relatively small, but it's part of the game. You know, sensible politicians, there's a famous quote, I think it was from Dennis Healey, the British Labour politician, saying, well, if you go into politics, you've just got to accept the media. You've got to live with it. And they're going to annoy you, of course, but don't let it, you know, really rile you. But they very often do. And they also think that winning over, say, in the West, newspaper proprietors is the key to electoral victory. I mean, you know, people will say, OK, yes, the backing of the Murdoch press for Margaret Thatcher is a great example of that. But I think there were figures from one of the Thatcher elections, I can't remember, maybe it was 79, where a majority of readers of The Sun, which, of course, backed her ferociously, actually sympathised with the Labour Party. So I think it's more that the media, including broadcast, including all kinds of new media, create a climate, a context. Mm. But I'm not sure that they have really the immediate effect that politicians certainly think they do. And, of course, newspaper proprietors, because they want to be invited to the seats of power.
Power with all the big shots. I just wonder, as you look to the impact then that journalists can have, do you worry that that impact is perhaps diminishing as this landscape becomes more fragmented? And do you fear for the quality of journalism, the quality of writing that holds these very politicians to account? Is that a worry?
Yes. I mean, despite what I just said, I think to have an independent, intelligent, analytical media is an essential part of a democracy, and I would say even an efficient state. I mean, I think one of the problems, for instance, in China is that you have no alternative voice there in China. You can't have a debate in China. I'm sure there are debates in the behind the closed doors of the Politburo, and they're probably at each other's throats and so on, but it doesn't come out. You don't have the press in this sense, the broadcast media are a safety, you know, there is an element of a safety valve, and I think when it works, it contributes very much to democracy and the efficient working of society. But there's no doubt that people are moving away from you know, I sound like a terrible old fogey here, but moving away from the kinds of media where you have that kind of debate. Because with all respect to, you know, Twitter and Facebook and so on and so on, you have a different kind of debate with people putting a point of view, often very ferociously, but there isn't the kind of discussion there. And I mean, my son, who works in this world, was saying that actually now, according to various polls, a majority of people, their first source of information now is Facebook there. Now, what it is, I'm not quite sure, but, you know, and I sound like a terrible old gatekeeper who wants to control what people say.
No, I think you're probably articulating a view actually that's more widely held than you.
I think there is a danger here.
Well, on that point, you know, people talk about the rise of citizen journalism, this sort of thing. Many followers of, I don't know what you'd call it, traditional media, yeah, who understand the virtue of having an editor and having, sure, to justify your line or your story at a news meeting, for example, say, look, citizen journalism is good in that it's democratizing, but it's not necessarily good in terms of quality journalism or actually conveying useful information that has real utility to people. As a, I don't mean this pejoratively at all, but as a traditional newsman, does that worry you? Do you feel like maybe our craft is suffering because of that?
I think it is. I think it is there. But then, of course, that raises a different question, which is the fundamental question about journalism, is what is journalism? I mean, it's not a profession in the sense you don't have to pass exams to become a journalist. Is it just a trade where you're selling something as much as you can with the advertising that goes with it, of course? Is it a craft, you know, like somebody sitting in a room writing an illuminated manuscript all his or her life and then showing it to the world? You know, how do you judge the success of a journalist in the end, and what gives a journalist the right, if you like, to tell people things through a lens which inevitably will be personalised to some extent or not, or above all, to write editorials and leaders telling people what to think? I was on the British newspaper The Independent when it set up just 30 years ago now, and we were full of squeaky clean principles, of course, there. And I remember debating this and raising at one point, you know, should we just run a newspaper without an editorial leader column? And of course, I was laughed out of out of the office, promise that. But there is this question of, I suppose it does come down in the end to, you judge journalism by whether it is giving people what they want, which may not be the lowest common denominator, as snobbish people would put it. I mean, it may be that some of the newspapers that seem to be doing it, the old-fashioned newspapers that seem to be doing best at the moment, are in fact quite high-level elites and are probably bought as much for their analysis and comment and opinion pages as they are for the actual news which people will be getting through other media. So when you say let the market decide, the market isn't purely, you know, to get as many million eyeballs as possible looking at the nudes on page 3 or whatever it may be. There are many, many graduations of this, but I am frankly somewhat worried. On the other hand, it may be that that kind of journalism, that kind of debate, that kind of analysis is migrating into other media forms, and that simply the problem is that most conventional journalists haven't been very good at following it.
Jonathan Fenby, fascinating to speak with you. Thanks so much for coming to join us, sharing a wealth of wisdom with us here on The Stack. And that is it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Ben Rylan, and editor, Toby Hammond. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. You can always listen again or delve into the archive at monocle.com or via iTunes. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards, and until next time, it's goodbye.